Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
My sense is that today, ballooning mostly is a curiosity. But what I found amazing as I was reading your book is how much ballooning once captured the public imagination, especially in the 19th century. Can you give us some sense of how widespread this fascination was?
Yeah, it is true. I mean, most people think flying began, let's say, with the Wright brothers in a Kitty Hawk, 1903. But actually, people were flying in balloons for 120 years before then. And it all began in the 1780s, 1783, when a paper bag manufacturer called Montgolfier, two brothers, discovered that if they filled a very large paper bag with hot air, it would take off. And it would take off with amazing power. I think the first one they launched went to something like 5,000 feet, and they suddenly realized, we've got something here. And within that year, 1783, they'd brought their invention to Paris, and they launched the first man-carrying balloon, amazing balloon, 60 foot high, that flew right across the River Seine, across Paris. And that created a complete sensation right across Europe, but very particularly in Paris and in London, because it was thought that here is the invention of an utterly new form of transportation. And I remember the president of the Royal Society in London, Joseph Banks, wrote a paper saying, this is the biggest invention since ships, okay?
Wow.
So for about 20 years, the idea was that this would completely transform the way we could move around and move cargo around and move people around. And in the first 20 years, you have balloons flying all over Europe and also here in America. First balloon, I think it's about 1794, Frenchman Jean-Louis Blanchard, Jean-Pierre Blanchard, flying out of Philadelphia. Hmm. Very interesting flight there.
What were those early balloons made of?
Very good question. The first ones, the Montgolfiers, were literally made of paper stuck together. And then they started making them of silk and taffeta. And the early ones were actually buttoned together. And then they developed various forms of technology. They could put particular kinds of glue and so on them. And a very important point, they were also doing hydrogen balloons. So the Montgolfiers were just hot air, literally with an open brazier burning beneath them. But the French Academy had isolated hydrogen, so had the Brits. And they realized that it was a gas which is roughly something like 14 times lighter than air. And so most of those early balloons were made of silk and inflated with hydrogen. And actually, that maintained that way of flying balloons really throughout the 19th century. It's the hot air balloons that we all know now, which are worked with ripstop nylon and these wonderful propane burners. That's a slightly different technology, and it looks different too.
Yeah. Now, there's something deeply romantic about this history of ballooning. I mean, it's beautiful, it's mysterious, and it's also dangerous. Is that what drew you to this story?
Well, it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. I don't know. When I'm talking about it, I often ask in the lecture, how many people here have flown a balloon? And usually it's about a quarter, maybe a quarter of the people. And then I say, I'm going to ask you how many want to fly in a balloon after you've heard the lecture, all right? the numbers go down a bit. No, the first thing is, it never occurred to me. When I was a kid, I first flew in, I think, apart from the party balloon that was tied to the top of my shirt when I was four, I think, and I thought I was going to fly. You know, those helium balloons that we all have. Mm-hmm. That started me dreaming. And then I flew out of France, and then I've flown all in Australia and here in America, notably at the Albuquerque International Balloon Festival. Wonderful thing. It's the beauty of it, the fact that it's a completely different experience from flying, particularly in modern airliners, all right? It's calm. You see the world laid out beneath you in a completely different way. It's a sort of meditative experience. And you see nature, you see the light, the way the sunlight falls on the ground, very, very differently. And you see the patterns of the agriculture and the patterns of cities. You see the kind of evolution of mankind on the earth in a quite extraordinary way. So it's visionary from that point of view. You've mentioned danger. Technically, I know there have been these terrible disasters like Luxor and one in Wellington. It does occasionally happen. But actually, statistically, I think it's certainly a lot safer than riding on a bicycle through New York. That's for sure.
Well, there are, though, some extraordinary stories. I mean, we'll talk about the early history, but even more recently, you tell the story of a Catholic priest in Brazil a few years ago who took off in a balloon and he was trying to raise money for some humanitarian cause. He went up to 19,000 feet.
Yeah.
And then he disappeared.
It's extraordinary. Sorry, 2008, Padre Balanero, it was called, yes. There is this long history in ballooning of people doing it for charity because it draws crowds and it's a wonderful way of raising money for charitable causes. This guy was raising money for, it was a truck driver's rest stop, okay? It was partly just give truck drivers rest, and I think it was a sort of a kind of spiritual restroom as well, you know, the way you could just calm down. He'd raised successfully some money in the spring of that year by going up with a number of small, like helium party balloons, slightly bigger, tied to him, and had raised a lot of money. And he decided to do a much bigger one. Well, I can't remember. I think it's something like 1,000 balloons. And he took off, and he had a GPS navigation equipment. He had a cell phone and so on. He's talking to the Coast Guards, and something, it went to nine, it went too high, and then it went out over the sea, and he was lost, and his body was found 2 or 3 months later. But it had an extraordinary effect, this, and he did indeed raise a lot of money. And people think maybe he was a saint, that guy, amazingly brave to do. So there is a story, that kind of story runs right through ballooning, people who do it for absolutely altruistic motives. But there are also others who are sort of showmen, and some of them are scientists, and some of them are crazy exhibitionist people.
And then there are some people who actually use balloons to escape to safety. And you tell a remarkable story of two East German families who got out of the Iron Curtain in a balloon. Can you describe what happened there?
Yeah. I mean, again, this is what I would try to do in the book is show that ballooning actually has so many aspects. It gives you different views of history and the reasons why people are doing it. And escaping is definitely one of them. The modern story I tell, yes, is 1979, two East German families wanted to escape over the war into West Germany, passionately wanted to do this. And funny enough, had read an account of one of the early festivals at Albuquerque, hot air balloons, and they decided to build their own balloon. I tell the story. It was very difficult for them to do. They had to get hold of the equipment because the secret police, the equipment of the Stasi in East Germany, were on to if anything peculiar like that happened. So they had to pretend they were members of a camping and a sailing club, but they got hold of different kinds of canvas and materials, burn-proof, non-flammable materials, which helped them in the end. And they built, I think, three versions of this balloon with their own homemade propane burner. And in autumn 1979, they did at night successfully launch. Can you imagine? Two families with, I think they had three or four kids, one of whom was a child in arms. And I found the photographs of this because they did successfully at night fly over, not the wall, but the wire fencing, you know, which is absolutely was lethal in those days. Which was mined and everything, and searchlights. And the drama of amazing dramas, like the balloon caught fire when at 9,000 feet, but they managed to control it. And when they came down, they didn't know which side of the wire. It was still night. They didn't know if they'd made it or not. And it's very dramatic the way they tell it. They got down in one piece. The kids were okay. One of the grown-ups broke their leg, but otherwise they're okay. But they didn't know which side of the fence they were. And the story is, they walked across the field. They could see there was a big electricity pylon, one of the most dangerous things, incidentally, for balloonists. They'd missed it. They walked up to it, and they had a notice on the bottom. Danger of death, etc. And underneath it had the name of the firm, and it was a West German electricity firm, and they knew they'd made it. And that is it's an amazing story, and it raises a lot of the kind of almost moral issues of ballooning, because obviously they were very brave to do it, and they were passionate that they wanted to get into free West Germany. They felt this very, very strongly. And yet, you know, did they have the right to risk particularly their children's lives on this? It's a very difficult issue, and ballooning raises these kind of questions. Incidentally, that story is so extraordinary that Disney made a film, a very good film with Jeff Bridges, I think called Night Crossing, which I think you can still get on DVD. So that's a kind of example of where ballooning takes you. You wouldn't expect it. And there's one other story I can tell you about escaping, if you want.
Sure.
Which goes back in history. One of the great moments of ballooning throw yourself back into France in 1870. The Franco-Prussian War has been declared, and the amazingly efficient Prussian army surround the city of Paris. It takes them 2.5 weeks, completely seal off the city of Paris, all right? And there is no communication then. You have to imagine, we're not in radio, mobile phones, anything like that. The only system would be telegraph. All those lines were cut. All the bridges were cut. The river was fenced off. 2.5 million people in Paris, completely isolated. And the idea of the Prussian army was simply to starve them into submission. But the worst thing was they had no communications with the outside world at all. So the ordinary private citizen in Paris, they had no communications with their families outside in France, but they had no diplomatic communications with America or with London, completely sealed off. And it was a despairing situation until there were a group of French balloonists who suddenly said, I've read the wonderful paper they wrote, they sent in to, they were still publishing news in Paris. They said, the Germans, the Prussians have us around. There's one way open, the traditional, the great way that we pioneered, the air. So they built very, very fast. They took over the railway stations. People will know, you know, the Paris, the Gare du Nord, Gare de Lyon, those big, high-roofed buildings. They were no use because the trains were stopped. And they used those to manufacture, mass-produce balloons. And in the space of 4.5 months, this winter, siege, hungry, everybody hungry, all the trees in the Bois de Boulogne were cut down. They killed all the horses. There wasn't a horse alive in Paris, so they ate them. It was a desperate situation. And the one thing they could do was get balloon messages out. They sent out, in the end, 67 balloons, and they carried basically airmail, and they carried, in the end, over 2 million letters out. And they carried certain key politicians who were going to help with the revival of France, some scientific equipment. Quite extraordinary. And the balloons had to go up, take off mostly from the heights, Montmartre, people will know that, then a hillside. They sent the balloons up there kind of 2 or 3 a week. It was very dangerous. They had to gain enough height to get over the Prussian lines. The Prussians had the big Krupp guns that would fire at the balloons, but they got 67 of them out. And of course, it didn't matter in which direction they went. The old problem of balloons, they're not good transport because you can start from A, but you can never get to B, right? You go, you leave A and you go to X and you don't know where. But for this purpose, all you had to do was fly over maybe 60 miles to clear the Prussian lines in any direction. And those balloons, quite amazingly, they went all over France. The first balloon landed somewhere near Tours, and it had a letter, wait for this, to the London Times, saying, your readers will want to know what the situation is in Paris. Here it is, written by a wonderful balloonist photographer people may know of, called Félix Nadar, a very famous photographer, who also, incidentally, I'm now digressing wildly, he invented aerial photography from balloons. That's another story, okay? So one of these balloons, the best story, I think, is it took off in a storm. It got over the Prussian lines. It went kind of northeast, north-northeast. And can you imagine this? In 15 hours, when they came down, they were on a snow-covered mountainside in Norway.
Wow.
Norway. Okay. and they had 4 bags of mail. And damn me, they got those bags of mail. The local farmers helped them to Christiansen. And most of them were delivered within 10 days. And I've seen some of the originals, and they're addressed out here. I've seen one, I had it in my hand, at least a photocopy of it, which is addressed to addressed in San Francisco, also to Australia, Sydney, Australia. So this is quite amazing, this balloon post. They also invented the first airmail newspaper. The Figaro ran it, and they sent it. Was called Paris Post, and it went out every week, and it described what was going on in Paris, and it carried sort of private adverts. And the great thing was that beleaguered population could communicate with the outside. And I should have added, the balloons also carried pigeons, and so they could carry messages back into Paris, letters. So they created, for that 4.5 months, this amazing airmail system, which did the best thing for the morale of the people in Paris. So that's a heroic story, and I follow the names of the particular balloonists who were involved in that. So again, ballooning gives you an absolutely, suddenly, completely unexpected view of history and that moment in history.
Yeah, that is a great story. And and one thing that comes through is, I mean, the history of ballooning is the history of great stories. I mean, going back to the early days, and I want to talk about some of the early entertainers, because back in the in the early 1800s, there were people like, well, there was a French woman, Sophie Blanchard.
Yes.
Tell me about her.
Well, often, again, when I'm talking about this, a voice from the back says, what about the women? All right. Was this a boys only? No, it was not in any way. And Sophie Blanchard, who was obviously French, born in La Rochelle, and she began ballooning just around 1800, when it's still the period of Napoleon and so on. And she was the most extraordinary character. I gradually being able to found some pictures of her and some letters she wrote. And she was this little petite girl, really, and because she began very, very young in her teens and 20s. She was originally the second wife of Jean-Pierre Blanchard, the man who came to Philadelphia, who got old and died. And I think he was a very difficult husband, incidentally. And Sophie's life really began when he died in a balloon accident. She took over the ballooning very, very young, in her 20s. And there was this very shy, timid young woman. Wonderful description. I found out that she hated the noise of the carts going over the cobble wheels. They were too cobblestones, right? They were too loud. They would make her jump. She was very nervous, okay? But once she got in the air, she was amazingly courageous, absolutely reckless in a way. And she designed her own silk balloons. These are hydrogen balloons. And I have in a picture of the book of the basket she designed. Which you would not believe. I describe it as like a large champagne bucket. It was tiny. It was silver. She was just big enough for her to sit curled up in it. She claimed to have spent overnight up in the air sleeping in her champagne bucket. She used to wear these wonderful white, elegant, tight white dresses with big feather hats so she could be seen. So she would go up in this tiny little champagne bucket basket. And then, this is what she became famous for. Remember, she's in a hydrogen balloon, right?
Right.
Hydrogen, one of the most inflammable gases known on Earth, right? It's number one, I think, in the periodic table. What she did with that was she started taking fireworks up, okay? And she built more and more complicated rigs, sort of booms, wooden booms, with various kinds of fireworks hanging off, which she had a system of being able to light. So she would go up over the parks, particularly over Paris, and she would do these aerial firework displays. Crazy, beautiful, very effective. And the really interesting thing about Sophie Blanchard, she was so good at it that Napoleon, who was then emperor, made her the official balloonist of the French Empire. And he used her for any ceremonial events. I've found pictures of her over Milan when he was down, Napoleon was down there doing for some, I think it was the celebration of his imperial crowning. She did this amazing firework display, and she did it all over France. And she had a huge following. British visitors used to come over after the peace to watch her. And she survived with the change of when Napoleon was defeated and went into exile. The Bourbon royalist monarchy came back. No problem for her. She was immediately made the official royalist balloonist, all right? And she gave these wonderful displays all over the Luxembourg, the Tivoli, all those big gardens. And they became more and more complicated. And she had a tremendous fan club. And then in 1819, the inevitable happened. Her balloon caught fire. And she crashed onto her roofs in a street in Paris and died. She's got a rather neglected but very beautiful monument. If anybody's in Paris, ask for Sophie Blanchard's monument in Père Lachaise. A very beautiful tomb with a kind of balloon figure mounted above it. And she still has a following. I discovered once when she was flying in Italy, she landed in a little alpine mountain village whose name just at this moment escapes me. But from that one landing, they have a Sophie Blanchard Day to this day.
Wow.
They have a celebration there.
Yeah.
And I think somebody's making a little animated movie about it. So she was a very good example of the early entertainers and very interesting woman, I think.
Well, you mentioned Napoleon's fascination with ballooning, and not yes. surprisingly, there were military leaders who thought, oh, you know, this could be a tool for war. Was it effective in actual battle?
Well, the early revolutionary army tried to use it at the Battle of Fleurus, I think, about 1794. It wasn't too successful. It's very difficult to use balloons under war conditions. We'll come back for a moment. But Napoleon did create the first sort of official balloon regiment, and he took them when he invaded Egypt. And there was just one problem. He had about 8 balloons with all their equipment aboard one of the ships in his fleet, who they sailed down to Egypt. They anchored in a little bay called Aboukir Bay. And the following evening, Lord Nelson's British fleet sailed in and sank the whole lot, including the balloon boat. So they were never able to use it, and he closed down the regiment. But, the possibility of using balloons as spotters, you can imagine, above an army. And I think the great example which I look at that is, in fact, here in the American Civil War. People forget this, I think. In the first 2 years of the war, and particularly in 1862, when they were running the Peninsula Campaign, you know, just south of Washington, they used spotter balloons. There was a very heroic figure called Thaddeus Lowe, Professor Thaddeus Lowe, who was known to the Smithsonian Institute. He corresponded with the famous Professor Joseph Henry, one of the great American scientists of the period, and he developed spotter balloons, and there are amazing stories of him going up above the battlefield. And in fact, you get the first impression, this is quite sobering really, that from a balloon, suddenly you have an outside observer who really sees what a modern battlefield is like. So he's not actually down there with the infantry, with the cavalry. He's above, kind of godlike, watching this. And he sees how terrible it really is, what the effect of shells they had, the early, not Gatling, but early automatic guns. And they had these long-range rifles. They used grenades and things. All this is described from someone above it, 2,000 feet above. And you can hear what's going on. You can hear what is happening to the troops below. You hear the screams of the men. Very, very sobering. Also, I mean, he was a brilliant observer. His most famous coup was when the Union army was besieging Yorktown on the peninsula. And they thought the rebel armies were dug in there and would never leave. And he was at night, a very good example of balloon observation. Night flying on a fixed line at about 2,000 feet using binoculars. And he saw the campfires in Yorktown, and he could see wagons going past the campfires. And they appeared to be coming into the city. So they thought, most of the Union officers thought that the South was reinforcing Yorktown. But what Thaddeus Lowe saw through his binoculars is that the wagon wheels were light when they came in. When they passed in front of the fires, he could see that they were high on their suspension. And when they left, they were very low on their suspension. QED, they were piling stuff and they were taking it out. And he takes this report about 1 a.m. to the headquarters, and the Union Army knows what's happening and they can react very much faster. So there are examples of that. And the battle of, we won't get it, but the battle of 7 days battle outside Richmond, the rebel capital, very dramatic. And there what Lowe is able to do. And also, don't get me too far on this because it's such an amazing story. The South, the rebel South were poor, as we all know, in finances and mechanical equipment and so on. And it was said they couldn't afford a balloon, except they could afford one balloon. And this was called, there's a legend, it's called the silk dress balloon, all right? And it was called that because the story was that all the Southern belles donated their ballroom dresses so they could be sewed together to make this beautiful silk balloon. And everybody thought this was a complete legend, a kind of rebel legend, all right? But I discovered, and not purely me, through some brilliant American researchers here, we gradually tracked down the letters about, and this balloon really did exist, and it was flown out of Richmond during the siege. And it really was made of silk, not necessarily, it was dress silk, which had been bought from women's outfitters in Charleston, Virginia. and this balloon really was beautiful, and it was very, very interesting. And Lowe saw it once through his binoculars. So that's the Union observer looking across the lines about 5 miles distance. And hell, he couldn't believe it. There was a rebel balloon, this beautiful silk dress balloon. And what happens to that is very, very interesting, very touching. And I got one little kind of basket to attach to this story, because as you said at the beginning, balloons are the source of wonderful stories. That this balloon, when it was finally captured, it was cut up, and the bits of it, the silk dress bits, became very precious souvenirs, both to the South and the North. And senior army officers had bits. And Lowe, Thaddeus Lowe, himself got a bit of this balloon. And when he retired to California, his archive, he's very, very interesting man, wrote lovely letters, had a very interesting family who looked after his papers. The papers were finally sent to the Library of Congress in Washington. And while I was researching there, I was going through his letters, and I unfolded one of these letters when he was quite an old man. And damn me, out of it fell this piece of the original silk dress balloon that he'd got.
Wow, that's
and
amazing.
And my heart kicked, I tell you. I did not put it in my pocket. I folded it very carefully back up.
But good
so,
for you.
One of the stories.
Yeah. Well, there's one last story I want you to tell, another remarkable expedition. This is at the end of the 19th century. There was a Swedish expedition to try to get to the North Pole in a balloon, which was just incredibly challenging. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I said all the different kinds of balloonists they were, and we haven't even talked about the high-altitude balloonists, the guys who went to 7 miles without oxygen and established, these are British guys, James Glaisher, established that we live inside this very thin biosphere skin. It's only 7 miles thick. You can't breathe above that. The whole of our planet depends on this little skin, 7 miles thick. 1862, they, balloonists, were the first to establish that. This has meant something to the environmentalist movement ever since. But the story you asked me about was, again, another scientific expedition run by the Swedes, a very interesting man called Solomon André. And his idea was that the poles had not been explored. No one had got to the poles. And before the 19th century was out, someone should discover what there was at the North Pole. And he was trained as an engineer. He'd come as a young man to America, very interesting. He'd traveled down from New York and to Philadelphia, one of the big world fairs. And he talked to the great American balloonist, John Wise. And he went back to Scandinavia with the idea that the way to get to the North Pole was by the most modern engineering methods, which was to fly there. So he built this balloon called the Eagle, originally the North Pole. Huge balloon, one of the biggest gas balloons ever built. He had a crew of three. And the idea was to set off from that northern island, Spitsbergen, just on the edge of the Arctic Circle, and to fly, it's approximately 660 miles to the North Pole, and to go down and put a Swedish balloon marker there and say, we've conquered the North Pole. And I followed the story because there's a lot of diaries and papers that survived. The three air crew, so interesting. Andre, who was a scientist, he was one of the earliest atmospheric scientists, wrote very interesting papers. And around this group, the first papers projecting climate warming were written by this group of Scandinavian science people. Mm-hmm. Andre himself recruited a senior meteorologist who in the end wouldn't go, and a young man whose name was Niels Strindberg, who was actually the nephew of, you know, the great playwright, right, August Strindberg, who was he was 25, very gifted. He was trained as a scientist, but he was also a musician. He could paint, he could play the violin, and he took very good photographs. It's one of the reasons he was taken. So that was the second member of the crew. The third was a very athletic young Swede who was brawn on the expedition. off they took, 1897, flying on what they projected would be a wind going due north all the way to the pole. And it did go for the first 24 hours, and then the wind changed, and it went to the east, and it went to the west, and gradually ice built up on the balloon surface, and they got lower and lower, and finally they were bumping on the ice. They were all keeping diaries at this time, like, Arctic explorers do. And on the third day, the balloon came down on the ice, and they were just around 83 degrees north, which is still about 400 miles short of the pole. And Niels Strindberg took this amazing series of black and white photographs of the balloon at the moment it had come down the ice. Very brave thing to do because, you know, they were really, they'd had it. They were facing death at that point. And I use some of them in the book. And it's like the end of the great romantic period of ballooning and scientific ballooning. And they try. They don't give up. They've got some sledges and a boat. And can you imagine? They hack back all the way south. The winter's closing down on them. Sun rises less and less high on the horizon. It's getting colder and colder. And they're getting more and more exhausted. They're shooting polar bear. And the really terrible thing I discovered from their diaries is that as they walked south, trying to get back to Spitsbergen over the ice with these three sledges carrying all their equipment, the ice pack was moving north.
Wow.
So it was like trying to go up a moving staircase when the staircase is coming down. So heartbreaking stuff in their diary. They would walk for 3 days and then they could just occasionally take a sun sight, and they'd realized they'd exhausted themselves walking maybe 10 or 12 miles, and the ice had taken them back 10 or 12 miles.
So they must have known they were doomed, and yet they were recording the whole thing as they were slowly going towards their death.
They were keeping the diaries. Niels Strindberg was taking the photographs. And they kind of never gave up. They finished up on a tiny little island. They did get quite far south, called White Island. And then the expedition goes to pieces, really. The diaries break up. There are no more photographs. And the one very moving thing, their bodies weren't discovered for 30 years. No one knew what had happened to them till after the end of the First War. And they were discovered quite by chance. They'd kept all their diaries, all the letters. Niels, this is heartbreaking. It's one of the heartbreaking stories. He was writing a continuous letter to his fiancée. He was engaged to be married when he got back. So he wrote this letter just like a diary. Kind of every other day he puts a new message to her. And this goes on until it finally just stops. And he obviously died first because they actually, exhausted as they were, they buried him under a stone cairn on this island, which was discovered. And their own bodies were lying under a kind of tent they'd made. And it looks to me, looking at the detailed descriptions of this, that the tent was made of the balloon material, of the silk material for the Eagle balloon, so that they lay under the material of the balloon. You imagine it flapping in that Arctic wind, and that's how they died. So it's a very sobering end, but to me, it is completely heroic. They were doing this in the cause of science. They were taking amazingly risks. Again, the question we began with, which ballooning rises, was it worth the risk? Were they justified in risking their own lives to try this? Maybe yes, maybe no. So that's the in a way, the last story, but it's not, because, of course, this now opens up the whole era of real flying. And they blazed the way. They'd proved that mankind could fly. And they'd proved that we saw our planet really differently once you go up. And I may say to anybody, listeners out there, if you get the chance to go up in a modern hot air balloon, go, because you will see the world differently. You will have a life-changing experience. And it's very safe.
You've made me want to go. Yeah. Well, one of the things that has struck me so much about a lot of your writing, certainly this book and also your last book, The Age of Wonder, is that you were clearly fascinated by the experience of wonder. And I want to ask you a little bit about that. What does wonder mean to you?
Yeah, good. It's almost a philosophic question, isn't it? The way I got onto this, I just have to go back. When I began, I've written, I think, about 18 books now. And my early books are all about writers, literary writers, particularly romantic writers, okay? And particularly that period of romanticism, which is a period of wonder when the world seems new, political hope seems new, seeing nature seems new. And then gradually, in my great old age, around the age of 60, I began to think, well, wait a minute, there's a whole element missing from this story, which is what were the science people doing? So my most recent books, and The Age of Wonder and this balloon book, they are about the way the arts world, the literary world, the writing world meets the science world. So a thing we haven't mentioned in the balloon book, there are a lot of writers in it. Edgar Allan Poe, very interesting on ballooning. Jules Verne, of course. Dickens, who was hated and terrified balloons. H.G. Wells, even young writer Ian McEwan, our modern writer, and so on. Now, these people respond to what I've called a sense of wonder, the sense of something utterly new out there, and the need to discover it, and the beauty of it. And the beauty and the danger, kind of, as you asked me at the beginning, they seem to go together. And this, for me, was a generation, the late 18th century, early 19th century, where people did respond with wonderful sort of freshness to the world. And I think we've still got it. It's still there, but it's very precious. And it's partly why I try and write these histories and bring it to life and tell the stories with this sense of the new, the amazing. And also, I have to say, the optimistic. There's something, the promise, when you see something wonderful, it's heart-lifting. And you think, yeah, it's all worth it. Let's keep on with this. And my books are very much about that, despite everything, the danger and the disaster. They're about the nature of hope. My great subject, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the poet, used to write about hope, the metaphorical and the metaphysical force of hope in everybody's lives. You need to hope for things. And wonder is something that gives you, powers up this hope. So I have a kind of, I don't know what you call that message, but it's science and literature together and something else, something more metaphysical, which I passionately believe in. Let's hope for stuff. Let's go for it.